there was a essay I read the other day that kind of read like a book report, like UVA law was founded in da 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 da. You know, it's like, you know, less researchy and more just talk from your own voice.
If you find yourself inserting footnotes, it's time to perhaps second guess your tone.
Great point.
This is Admissible. I'm Natalie Blazer, Dean of Admissions at UVA Law. We are in the thick of admitted student recruiting right now, which always puts us in a happy mood. What puts us in a less happy mood is when applicants do things that we would characterize as inadmissible. So we're going to run through some observations from this cycle that are making some applicants just impossible to admit. But also, I want listeners to keep in mind before we start that no law school application is perfect. I have said this a few times on the podcast before, but there's a big difference between having an imperfect application and having an inadmissible application. We have, I would venture to say, hundreds, potentially thousands of applicants who are admissible. Some of those people can't be admitted just because we have a limited number of folks in the first year class. That's not who we're talking about. We're talking about the people who do certain things that make themselves inadmissible and they kind of take themselves out of the game. Okay, so before we dive in, I have to tell you guys, in preparation for today's recording, yesterday I queued up our last two director debriefs that the three of us did together. And I was like laughing out loud.
Because we're so funny?
Well.
Or so wrong about what we thought.
In the November episode, which was the halfway point of this current cycle that we're in, you know, at the end, I said, you know, is there anything else you guys want to share with listeners? And Roseanne, you said, we just can't wait to read more. And like, would any of us say that right now?
We've read a lot.
Like, I was just so struck between our energy and enthusiasm for reading in November, like compared to how I feel right now. If you're someone who's thinking, and I get this question all the time, does applying earlier in the cycle versus later matter? Well, just ask yourself, do you want an enthusiastic, energetic admissions committee reading your file, or do you want like a depleted, kind of exhausted admissions committee reading your file? So another observation from that November 2023 debrief is that at that point, we had made about 25% of offers, a quarter of offers at the halfway point of the cycle. And I remember commenting that that meant that we were going rather slow. And for us, that is slow. But as of now, as of March 4th, when we're recording this episode, we've made more than like 90% of regular cycle offers. So it's wild to think how much ground we have covered in those 3 months, especially when you consider holidays, the office being closed, we converted our entire file reading software. You know, I raised that point not just to pat ourselves on the back for grinding out all those offers, but also I think it's helpful for listeners to know that, you know, even if a first half of a cycle is slow, it will pick up and you know, committees will be making up the time. And so, like, the cycle can start off slow, but the pace can really pick up in the second half. That's what we have seen. So having said all that, that extended intro, Katie and Roseanne, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So glad to be back.
So excited to have you guys back. So I wouldn't really call it an icebreaker since I feel the ice between us has long been broken.
Thoroughly broken.
It's water at this point. We're going to do it anyway, because I think it's really fun for listeners to envision a little bit more about Charlottesville life. So why don't you each tell us what your favorite restaurant in Charlottesville is?
My friends will hate me for this because they were like, can you stop telling people what our favorite spots are or more people will be there? But it will forever and always, I think, be the bar at Alley Light. It's a good vibe. Great people. Shout out to Nikki and to Micah. Just really love it there. And right now they have a passion fruit cheesecake. So excellent. Mm. 10 out of 10. Would recommend.
It's very good cheesecake. And one of the things I love about Alley Light that really kind of It exemplifies a lot of what Charlottesville is all about in the sense that even down to the bartender, they are out there finding local ingredients. Mm. Often he is foraging wherever he goes to forage and turning that into something really special and really uniquely Charlottesvillian. And I love that.
And there's a UVA law sticker on their refrigerator. So thanks for seeing us.
You love that.
So for me, this is by far the hardest question that I ever get asked. What is my favorite place to eat in Charlottesville? For me, it really kind of depends on the day, but I'm going to give a shout out to a place I got to eat for the first time this weekend, which is Uma's. If you know me, you know I could eat Korean food every single day of the week. Uma's is a fusion Korean restaurant and just had some really interesting things going on. And more than that, I love them because they are great community members here in Charlottesville. And that's something you will see in a lot of, I think, our local restaurants and businesses. They are supporting kind of the broader community efforts. They're holding space for people who may not always have space to be. And I really admire that about them, in addition to the fact that their food is just fantastic.
I love that something good went in that spot, because I just think of that spot as Mono Loco.
Mono Loco forever. Every time I drive past it, I say RIP Mono Loco.
I know. But I'm glad for Uma's. I'll have to try that. Maybe I should start a food podcast. Charlottesville dining podcast. But no, today we're going to talk about the sort of inadmissible things that we have seen, particularly in this cycle, but I think also it just applies generally. And these are things, of course, as with all of the episodes that focus on application advice, these are our opinions for the most part. But also, I think a lot of this is applicable to any school you're applying to. But I'm just going to put it out there that these are things that we personally find to be inadmissible. So
I think it's also really kind of important to say, like, it's still a holistic process. It still is a holistic process. But in a process where there is a lot of competition, like, don't throw up red flags that don't need to be there.
Exactly. It's sort of like dating. I feel like there are deal breakers and then there are, like, not ideal things. So, like, a lot of times we're like, well, I don't love this, but there's so much other good stuff here. So let's talk about the writing in general, the essays in the application. What do you feel are, like, deal breakers with the writing?
So this is something we mentioned maybe in our last go around, but being responsive to the prompt, reading the prompt. Again, we understand, you know, you're applying to a lot of law schools and the temptation is there to send the same personal statement to all of those law schools. But we saw quite a few this cycle that were not responsive to our prompt, which is signaling to us that you didn't take any particular special effort for us, which makes us less inclined to take any particular special effort for you.
The prompts were very carefully constructed to get the information that we want to know so that we can say yes. And so if you're not answering the prompt, then we are saying yes to certain things for other people that we cannot say yes for you.
And I would say that if you are not responding, it would be very difficult for other elements of your app to overcome, because that's just basics, right? It's not just like we want to punish you for not following the instructions. We need to know this information in order to make a decision. If you're not giving us the information, there's really nothing we can do for you.
And I think that's true both in, you know, the personal statement, but also in the question that we have the E13 now on the different qualities that we're looking for. Because I think there have been people who are like, this is a diversity statement or this is a YUVA statement. So I'm just going to paste my diversity or YUVA statement and put it in there as filler. And it's like, that's not what the question is asking you.
Or I know that you, UVA Law Admissions Committee, listed out 6 very specific traits, but I'm going to talk about this other trait. It's like, of course, there are more than 6 traits that are valuable, but, like, there's a reason we came up with those. I'm curious where you two fall on someone saying the wrong school name in an essay. Is that for you a deal breaker, or is that just annoying?
That is pretty close to a deal breaker for me. Not so much because I think, oh, no, they don't want to go to UVA. so much as I think they didn't take the time to proofread this.
Yes.
And this is an essential skill for law school. So it's really more the carelessness of it than it is the intent behind it for me.
I'll agree with that. But also, like, the carelessness when you don't have to be careless about it, because none of us require, like, naming schools for a particular reason. So if you're going to take this risk, you should follow through on it the best way that you can. Like, I think we say often, like, you don't have to have a YUVA. You don't have to address a specific thing for a specific school. But if you're going to take that road, you better get it right.
To use a baseball term, it's an unforced error. It's not so necessary. Sporty. So sporty today. I'm just going to put it out there that it's a deal breaker for me. And to echo what you two just said, but to even put more of a fine point on it, if you can't be bothered to read your 2-page personal statement one time, and if you are reading it over one time, you should catch that. So either you're reading it, but you're not reading it carefully enough to catch a mistake like that, or you're not even bothered reading it once before you submit it. And both of those are just not boding well for you. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about other elements of the application, unless you guys have anything to add about the writing portion itself.
I would say just in the writing, I think some people treat it as academic writing. And I'm like, this is your one spot to be yourself. Like, we would love to see some personality shine through.
Yeah, great point. Let's talk about letters of recommendation. I think for these, some of them can really, a letter can make or break a file, absolutely. And I think a lot of it comes down to who are you asking.
Most of them are good. So, like, don't freak out that, like, you know, you're probably this person who's going to mess this up. Most of them are good. But I do think there is an art form or, like, some strategy in how you choose, for sure.
Yes.
There are a few ways that an LOR can undermine you. One is you have chosen someone who has a critical statement to make about you. That is, I think, the biggest problem that you can encounter. One is an LOR that's coming through as somebody who really doesn't know you. And then the third is, I think there are some letter writers who think they're doing the right thing and they put the name of a specific school in. So, like, I couldn't recommend Roseanne more highly for Duke Law School. And then you're submitting it to UVA, not knowing that it says that because you haven't seen the letter of recommendation. But again, that's telling me something about the conversation that you probably had with that recommender about where you wanted to go to law school. So really just making sure that you're talking to your recommenders, that you are making sure that they know you, that they know why you want to go to law school, and that you're willing to put yourself out there and say, do you have any concerns about my candidacy for law school? Because if they do, you should move on.
Yeah. And I think more so in this cycle than previous, I'm seeing letter writers who are like a family friend or more of a colleague or an acquaintance. It's very strange. I have not seen this that much before. So in addition to they should know you well and they should have positive things to say about you, what is your relationship to them? You know, faculty member, a supervisor, something like that is appropriate. How do all of these things add up? And making sure that you're giving yourself the best chance by having the LOR add to your file. What about character and fitness infractions? What is it about a character and fitness that is a deal breaker for you guys?
Man, I think probably more strongly than both of you on this. And I don't know if it's the former RA in me or the former crim law person in me. I think this is where people, like, all of a sudden become their own lawyers, right? Like, then they're like, okay, well, I'm going to give as little as possible. And I'm like, that's not what this space is for. This space is for you to tell us exactly what happened, maybe how you feel about it. What irks me here is when there's a total lack of accountability, where it's like, are you sorry about it? Because if you're sorry, you should say so. Or, like, if you think that you were wrong, then you should say you thought it was wrong. I think for so many people, the tone can shift so dramatically that people end up feeling or sounding very blasé about it, as opposed to, giving it the reverence, I think. I don't know if that's the right word, that I think a situation like that accounts for. And what I sometimes see are people who have very minor CNF, and then they are very sorry about it. And then we have people who have bigger CNF issues, and they're just like, yeah, this happened, and nothing else happened after that. And I'm like, no, did you spend time reflecting on why this might not have been a good choice? Yeah. That, I think, is important.
And I think that I couldn't agree more. And I think that is particularly important where the underlying CNF involves lying and being untruthful in some way. Because when you are then addressing that in a very withholding way, you're making me wonder whether you did learn from that experience or whether you might lie in a similar way once you're in law school. But I think the accountability and the directness really go a long way. You know, for me, when I'm reading a CNF that's written in the passive voice, you know, I was found to have violated my dorm rules regarding XYZ thing. You're really distancing yourself from the event in a way that does make us question whether you learned from it or whether it is indicative of your character.
Remember what character and fitness, what that phrase means. It means, do you have the character and the fitness to practice law, to be a member of the bar? Distancing yourself, not taking responsibility, lying, like all these things, withholding, not disclosing, those are things that put your character and fitness for practicing law into question. 99% of character and fitness violations are not a big deal, and people who take accountability are completely fine. So this is not something that you should overthink, but just the tone is important here. Okay, we're going to get to a big one. Beyond sort of the written application, I want to talk about interviews. As I mentioned on our mid-cycle debrief, you two are interviewing like crazy. Thankfully, that is pretty much winding down for the cycle. We have a few more offers left to give, but we're getting to the finish line. So, you two have had some folks who proved to be inadmissible after the interview. So, what can you share about why and how that happened?
You know, it's funny because I feel like there are often times where you can tell from the tone of the scheduling that the interview might not go the way that you hoped. So I'm going to jump to that first. You know, when we send an offer for an interview out, I think we have both now fallen into a habit of trying to give a decently wide window. So when people are writing back to us in a tone that makes us feel like, you know, that window is somehow going to be a grand inconvenience for them for reasons that are either unclear or are things that would affect every candidate in our pool, right? You have classes, you have work. That's pretty much everybody that we're interviewing. So the person who says, my job is more important than this interview or my class is more important than this interview really stands out.
Well, and I think it's important to say, like, we do all of our own scheduling. It's a little bit old school, like straight up emails, like, and we do that to kind of coordinate the best for not just ourselves, but for the person who's interviewing and the other interviewees. And it makes a huge difference, I think, in the way that you reply to us. This is not a link. It's not like here are the available calendar slots. And on the flip side of that, I'm in a great mood when someone's so generous about it or like they are honest about their limitations. Like I've interviewed a lot of teachers who are like, hey, like, you know, I'm really like tied up most of the day, but I have this time during lunch. Like that makes me feel like, thank you so much for spending like your precious lunchtime with me. It is really hard when people are like, I can't meet with you until like Saturday at 5 p.m. And I'm like, I've literally talked to people on warships who, you know, are willing to make the time and effort that it takes to, you know, get to know each other better.
As Roseanne said on the previous debrief, interviewing is a labor of love. It is a lot of work. You two, it's very time consuming. And so, as we've said before, be excited when you get an interview invite and just be considerate to the people who are interviewing you.
So that's a lot to say about scheduling. What about the interview itself, once you are actually in the Zoom room with the person?
I think there are a lot of resources out there. And I think that it's important to utilize some of them. But I think sometimes it makes people over-prepare. And so there are some really softball kind of questions that I have that I think a lot of people know are coming, but they just start rattling off things. And then it's less of a conversation.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to prepare for the question, how was your weekend, right? We really just want to talk to you a little bit. And I think there are two other ways where that people kind of over-prepare in a very obvious way. One is that they have pretty much pre-written their answers to what they think our questions are going to be, and then it comes off as very robotic and kind of inflexible. I think that's kind of what Roseanne was getting to. The other is, again, we know there are resources out there, and all of our interview questions may not be total surprises to you, but we don't ask the same questions. And, you know, they're not exactly the same questions. And so one thing that is kind of a red flag to me is when somebody, I'll ask a question and someone will try to squeeze their answer into my question, but it was clearly something they had prepared for something that Roseanne would typically ask. Again, these are not hard questions. We're just hoping to get to know you. And so while I do appreciate that you want to be as prepared as you can possibly be, I do kind of question your basic communication skills at that point if you're unable to pivot and just have the conversation.
Right. As always, I appreciate you two being like a check on me and sometimes things that I think are unacceptable. And so here's one that I would love to know if you think I'm being too harsh, because I think sometimes I have strong opinions. What do you think about when someone has written out their questions for you at the end? Do you care? And that by no means is a deal breaker.
I don't. I know that bothers you a little bit more than it does me. To me, that is kind of standard preparation that I would probably do for an interview. I do appreciate when people raise questions that came up during the course of the conversation and it is a little more free-flowing. But I also can appreciate that people come into the conversation with some questions already on their mind. And that's okay, too.
Yeah, I'm with Katie on this one. I hate it when they read other things. I think questions are fair. I think sometimes people are interviewing with lots of places and they're like, oh, I never want to forget to ask this question. That I think I can give a little more leeway to. It's when they are, you know, preparing paragraphs and paragraphs or like consistently doing that throughout the interview that bothers me kind of more.
Yeah, it went like a lot of times I've noticed when I ask why you want to go to UVA, you can tell they're reading from something. Well, the John Olin Business Center and the Entrepreneurial Law Clinic, and you can just see their eyes darting and they're reading.
Natalie, I will also say one of the things is that people have been telling me they've learned so much on the podcast that they don't have as many questions. So maybe they need to prepare questions because
yeah,
we have been so thorough.
Well, okay, I'll take it. anything else on interviews?
I think my only other thing for interviews is I've had people who are so focused on the big ideas and like big values and all of these things that like they don't support their big ideas with like specifics. I think when you don't have specifics, things that can be cliche appear to be much more cliche.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I would focus on that too.
I want to sort of wrap up the interview part of this. I know we're talking about what makes people inadmissible or what deal breakers are, but 80% of the time, interviews are so great that we come out of our offices and we have to tell each other how great this person is. And then when it rolls around to this time of year, when people are coming to visit and they're depositing, and like, this is what keeps everything like so exciting. And this is why we do it, because
we want to get to know you as people and we get super excited about you as people. So net, like interviews are a very positive experience. And for the people who I think want to be at UVA and who have done just really even the basic preparation, it goes great. It goes great.
Yeah. Again, it shouldn't be hard.
Right. It's a pretty straightforward process. All right. Let's talk about visitors. Like when somebody comes to visit and they're an applicant, there are things that people do to sort of take themselves out of the running.
So we have designed our visitor schedule very deliberately. We have student-led tours. We have student life panels. We have drop-in classes. We have lots of different ways for you to get to know UVA. When you show up and you're trying to push beyond those offerings and not kind of respecting the schedule that's there, again, a lot of hard work goes into finding the faculty and the students who are going to serve as those ambassadors for you. So really just respecting that the schedule is there for a reason and not pushing beyond what's available there when you don't otherwise have a great reason to do so kind of puts everybody a little bit on edge.
Yeah. The best interactions with visitors and with people at fairs and forums and school visits are like short, sweet, positive, self-aware, done, right? It's true that a positive impression can put your file up to like the attention of we want to interview you. That does happen. I would say it's much more common for a negative impression to get your file flagged by our committee. And that's why I think this is an important topic to bring up on this inadmissible podcast episode, because making a positive impression, I think people have this idea in their head that if only they could get enough FaceTime with someone on the admissions committee, that's going to make all the difference for them. But in the process of trying to bring about that result, they cross over into the inadmissible territory. Again, the flip side can happen. The positive impression can definitely help you, but I feel that it just goes way more the other way.
And I think just the tone of our office and our team, we are not a group of people who are really going to appreciate your gimmicks, right? So dropping your letter of continued interest off in person or, submitting your application while you're sitting in our lobby, those kinds of things. Those aren't going to go very far for us, and chances are that you're creating an inconvenience for us, which is then yielding a negative impression.
I think just today I sent a file to you, Roseanne, for thoughts, and you said, I think his sort of interest and contact with our office is a little bit
excessive.
Yeah, excessive. And so this was kind of my next point, which is just like, again, for me, it's the lack, it's that our team is very strapped and we don't have a lot of time and energy and resources to devote to people who are excessively in touch with us. But it's, again, it goes back to the lack of self-awareness and the almost entitlement that, you know, if you just show enough interest or if you, you know, contact us so many times that you're going to get a different response, that irks me. And that, I think, we're talking about imperfect versus inadmissible. That person to me is inadmissible.
And I think one other thing that I think our whole team feels pretty strongly about is, you know, Dean Blazer makes herself available on Fridays for a Q&A. That is, I think, a very generous use of her time to make herself available in that way. This cycle in particular, we've had a number of people who are kind of hanging around, lurking around, trying to catch her while she's walking around the halls. None of us like that. We don't want you pouncing on her like that. And again, it's just leaving a bad impression for everyone.
That hour on Friday afternoons is like one of the highlights of my week. I love meeting applicants. I love answering your questions. I love hearing what you have to say. In fact, at a Q&A a few weeks ago, they were talking about the podcast and I asked for like podcast ideas. Like I love that block of time.
that hour is your time to make a good impression. How many times do I come back and say, this person, this person, this person? Like, I'm making mental notes of people in the Q&A. It's not like you are going unrecognized by me. That is, those are usually small, and that's the time to make a great impression. So we talked about sort of the tone of communications with our office, how you treat people, how often you're in touch. I definitely don't want to end on a bad note, but I want to just talk about like really egregious conduct. Like Katie brought up lying. Yeah, if you're going to be a member of the bar or if you're going to be a law student, especially at UVA where we have an honor code, like lying is just, that's the deal breaker, I would say.
That's my number one by a landslide. And it's because, you know, a big part of the reason I'm doing this job is because I care about what the future of the legal profession and the law is going to look like, which means I care a lot when you're behaving in a way that I find to be unethical or immoral or otherwise lacking in integrity.
And luckily for us and for the future of the bar, there are so many ethical people who are not doing these things. And so one real easy way to count yourself out of this process is to lie about something either in your application or in the admissions process. And it's not worth it. Remember that this is now 2024. A lot of our applicants were in this COVID era. We are used to resumes that don't look super perfect anymore, okay? There are gaps, there are odd jobs, there are, you know, people caretaking. That is all fine. Don't fudge anything in your application because, again, imperfect applications are admitted all the time, but lying is where we really don't, you know, have any patience for.
Yeah, and I think under the umbrella of honor, there's also cheating and stealing. And again, like most people are not going to have this issue. But if you do, it is really important, you know, not just to the bar, but as like a community member at this school. I mean, I think cheating is one of the big ones for you and me, Natalie. Like, I feel like when we talk about CNF issues, we're like, gosh, all things equal. If you have someone who has never cheated before, I'll take that person.
Yeah. Exactly. And again, we're not here sitting in judgment of you. Everybody makes mistakes. God knows I've made so many mistakes. It's when you're in a pool of 5,000 people and someone with your exact profile and credentials is on the next one in the stack without that. That's what you have to think about. We can't admit everybody and we have to make these difficult decisions. So we want to end on a high note, even though we're like talking about what makes people inadmissible. That's just our nature. I feel we said this in the mid-cycle debrief. We are rooting for everybody. We really are. The interviews, we get so excited about people. We have our big admitted student event coming up, which like makes us very excited / nervous. So end us on something that you love about a recent admitted student or something that happened in the second half of the cycle.
So I will say UVA's first round of merit-based scholarships went out last week. And this cycle, for whatever reason, more than others, I received quite a few thank yous from individuals who received a scholarship. And that just makes me feel so good to know not only that they're excited about UVA, but that they understand that they weren't entitled to receive XYZ scholarship, but they did, and they appreciate it. We even had one admitted student who happens to live in Charlottesville come by to thank us personally, which I just thought was so incredibly sweet. So, you know, it's things like that where, yes, we have spent a lot of this episode talking about kind of the small minority of people who are off-putting in one way or another. But truly, this job is great because we get to interact with people who are so excited to move into this next phase of their lives and to do it at UVA. And that just really, I mean, even in the hardest part of the cycle, that's what keeps me going.
And just to take a step back from that, that this is not about how we feel about you as a person or how, what, if we agree with you or not, or if we wouldn't do it the same way. We are trying to not stand in your way of getting to UVA law. And that's what's so gratifying about when we see people deposit and when scholarships go out and people are thankful for it. It's like, it's because of what you are ultimately going to bring to UVA. It sounds crazy, but Katie's absolutely right. When scholarships went out and we got a lot of positive responses, it's sad, but we're used to getting negative responses or this isn't enough for me, or, you know, and gosh, it's nice that when you give somebody thousands and thousands of dollars, they say thank you.
Yes. Yes. Can I do two high points?
Yeah.
You can edit one out if you want to. My other is just this year in particular, gotten to celebrate some real highs with some people who I have admitted who are accomplishing the dreams that they set out with when they came to law school.
Big dreams.
Big opportunities. And there is just nothing better than to get to play a role in that. So it's been a really great year.
I would say I have, you know, you're making me, now we could just do a whole nother thing about highlights. That is so true. We're still in it. Once you're students, we're just, we're more just rooting for you.
Yeah, we're your buddies at that
yeah.
point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we can just be friends. I think for me, actually, and this is like not one specific person, but I really love this time in the cycle because the reapplicants get to come back and live what they thought wasn't going to happen for them last year. Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite things about law admissions is like there are multiple ways to get where you're trying to go. And so I think as of late, like I've had a bunch of reapplicants who went and did something different, or they worked for a year, or they gave it another shot here or there on something that they thought they were weaker at. And to see it pay off, like, I'm excited for all of my non-reapplicant students, but like for people where you know that they have waited and worked for this opportunity, like for another cycle, and see that really kind of shine through, and their enthusiasm for UVA just grows. Like, I really, really love that too.
Such a great point. I can think of four or five, just sitting here off the top of my head, successful reapplicants this cycle who did the work, who waited. I think especially when you're so young, like a lot of these people that are applying are in their 20s. Wait a year seems impossible. And so for somebody to do that and then also put in the work and come back, yeah, we do love that. Well, leave it to us to do an episode called Inadmissible and then just rave on and on and on about what we do love. Katie and Roseanne, it's always so fun having you on the show. Thank you so much. And you are by now, by far, the most regular sort of repeat guests on Inadmissible. So thank you. I know it's a crazy busy time.
I love being on this podcast.
Thank you. Thanks, Natalie.
This has been Admissible with me, Dean Natalie Blazer at the University of Virginia School of Law. My guests today were directors of admission Katie DelSandro and Roseanne Ibanez. For more information about UVA Law, please visit law.virginia.edu. The next episode of Admissible will be out soon. In the meantime, you can follow the show on Instagram at @admissiblepodcast. Thanks so much for listening, and please remember to rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts.